from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Well, welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. I'm just going to talk today about some issues. It's been a pretty big week, shall we say, in the news. And I've been, last weekend, certainly this weekend, I've been on News Nation. I've been on Fox Live Now, or Live Now from Fox, I should say. I'm always turning that around. And along with local station coverage and things like that. So I'm going to talk about what's happening in the world, and it's really three big things. I think the thing that really blew up this week that got everybody's attention, or I should say over the last couple, 3 weeks, is Pakistan and India. And that is a long time, long simmering, if you want to call it, conflict that burbles up. And when it happens, all of a sudden you go from, I didn't know there was a big problem there, to, oh my gosh, are we going to have a nuclear war? And I'm going to talk about that. I'm also going to talk about what's happening with the talks in Iran, with Iran. We just finished a series of meetings in Oman. As you know, they've been going back and forth between Oman and Rome on these meetings. And this one did not really get very far. And I'm going to talk about where that's at. And then I'm going to also kind of finish. I'm also going to talk about what's happening. And I think it's something of, I overuse this phrase, a strategic inflection point, if you will, in what's happening with Ukraine and Russia. And I think it's really big. So let me kind of get going here and talk about a little bit of strategic risk. By the way, if you're investing, trying to figure out where to put your money today, if you're trying to figure out if you should put money into some sort of investment, business opportunity, whatever, you're looking at the world very, very closely. Certainly with what's happening with tariffs, what's happening with global conflicts, what's happening with supply chain issues, none of this can be overstated. And oh, by the way, I didn't mention this, and I should probably kick off with this, is there is a ceasefire between the U.S. and the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And this is interesting. It was announced, of course, by the White House that we'd reached this historic ceasefire agreement. Oman had mediated it. Pretty big deal, but interesting. It's not quite clear if the Houthis are going to stop firing at all ships in the Gulf of Aden, the Red Sea, the Bab el Mandeb Strait, or if they're going to stop just shooting at U.S. ships. And what does that mean if they just stop at U.S. ships? Because frankly, of the total percentage of ships that go through there, U.S. flag carriers are a very small percentage. There's not really that many of the total global maritime commercial shipping out there. U.S. flag carriers are not that huge. So I'm not quite sure what this is. And this agreement completely ignores the ongoing conflict or ongoing exchange of missiles and stuff with the Houthis firing upon Israel and firing upon what they presume are Israeli maritime assets. I just don't know. It looks like they're still going to be back and forth with Israel. Israel's going to keep attacking the Houthi areas, and the Houthis are going to keep attacking Israel. And of course, last week they actually put a missile into the David Ben-Gurion Airport, the main international air hub for Israel. It hurt some people. It caused some injuries. Fortunately, didn't kill anybody. Didn't hit a major facility or something there, but it got through. So that's got the Israelis looking at their entire air defense picture. They're an Iron Dome concept. And it appears that they did stop some missiles, some other missiles that were coming with it. Some of this may have been adaptive tactics by the Houthis on how to get the missiles through. Also, it's reported that the missile was a hypersonic missile, which makes it very difficult to intercept because of the speed and velocity at which it travels. Anyway, we're going to find out more about that, but that's a big problem. And of course, where did that missile come from? Well, from Iran to get into there, but the missile may have actually originated from someplace like Russia. And Russia is becoming a bigger backer, if you will, less covert. I never felt they were particularly covert in this. Less covert in being an agent of chaos and disruption by assisting the Iranians and assisting the Houthis to shut down a major global maritime artery. So anyway, we'll see where this goes. We'll see how broad this is, but I'm watching that closely. But let's talk about India and Pakistan, because as we used to say in strategic weapons, that's an area where two rules apply, horseshoes and nuclear weapons, close counts for both. And we had a really close call, and hopefully the ceasefire this weekend that has been announced by President Trump on Saturday morning, wasn't clear if it was an announcement and that India and Pakistan were completely on board with this. But anyway, let's talk about this. Anyway, last Wednesday, May 7th, India launched strikes that took place about 2 weeks after a big terrorist attack in Indian-controlled Kashmir killed 26 people, most of them tourists. It was absolutely horrific what they did. They lined them up, put them on their knees, made them recite the Quran, and if they couldn't do it, they would literally murder them, execute them in front of their wives, children. It was a horrific terror attack. These were Islamic extremists, jihadists, if you will. And going back in the history of the Kashmir Jammu area, which has been heavily contested by Pakistan and India, going back to the beginning of India and Pakistan, that these groups, these extremist jihadist groups, have historically been backed by the Pakistani military. And right now, the head of the Pakistani military was former head of its big intelligence service, and he had been fired by Imran Khan, who was the president or prime minister of Pakistan, who is currently being held in jail. And so the Pakistani military is in a very difficult political situation with the Pakistani people. Imran Khan is a very popular politician, very popular prime minister, former cricket star. And so they've been trying to, I don't know, rebrand themselves, make themselves relevant, try to rally the population behind the flag. And so there's a lot of reasons to believe that the Pakistani military may have had a role in this, may have seen that sponsoring this type of attack or helping this type of attack or whatever, or turning a blind eye, if nothing else, to these terrorist groups operating on their soil was a way to reinvigorate the passions of the Pakistani people. And you have to remember that when Pakistan and India originally broke up, it was based on religion. The predominantly Muslim areas went over to Pakistan. The predominantly Hindu areas went over to India, with one exception being Kashmir, which was about 70% Muslim, but the Maharaja that controlled Kashmir did not want to become part of Pakistan because he was Hindu, so he never let the Kashmir and Jammu province become part of India. Although it's been contested, some of it's controlled by Pakistan, a big chunk of it's controlled by India, and parts of it are actually controlled by China. So it is a flashpoint, if you will, on the global stage. Anyway, this is a disputed Himalayan region that both India and Pakistan claim as their territory in its entirety. So that's part of it. India blames Pakistan for the attack. Pakistan denies they had anything to do with it, but you know, that's part of the history going back, and there's a good reason why India believes that. Now, after the terror attack in April, India took some very strict steps about Pakistan. Under these steps, and probably the biggest one they took, was they temporarily stopped the Indus Water Treaty of 1960. This is a huge treaty, and this is where a lot of people miss this. You can explain the Kashmir issue with religion, and you go, oh, okay, I get it. Mostly Muslim, but under India, mostly Hindu, and they felt this should be part of Pakistan. Get it. Understand it. A little bit more complicated than that. Kashmir is, first off, it's, you know, a beautiful area. It's up at the up around the Himalayas, beautiful green valleys. Some call it the Swiss. There's parts of the Kashmir they refer to as the Switzerland of South Asia. And that's one of the reasons you see so much tourism resurging up there, which this attack threatened. Well, it's also the watershed for some major river systems, not the least of which is the Indus River and two of its tributaries that form basically the water lifeblood, if you will, of Pakistan. 80% of Pakistani agriculture relies on the Indus River and its two tributaries to keep it going. If you cut off the Indus River and its tributaries, which I'm just going to say the Indus River, if you cut off that Indus water flow under the treaty, basically it is a catastrophic event for Pakistan. In fact, you start to wonder, can Pakistan survive with its 250 million people as a viable nation state if something like that happens? So this is not an insignificant thing. And since 1960, despite all the wars between Pakistan and India that have happened, this treaty was never temporarily stopped, abrogated, whatever. This treaty had always stayed in effect until now. So Pakistan was looking at this saying, this is a really big deal, to say the least. And this was a major step that escalated the tensions between the two countries. While the Kashmir region and this treaty feeds both Pakistan and India, I should mention that the biggest impact on this would have been with that temporary stop on Pakistan. That's why India was not stopping the water that was going into it. And we talked about religion as part of it, but the brutal reality is, the real politic is, this is now, and it has been for some time, really a national security issue for Pakistan, dominated by the access to water. And so that's the big thing there. Now, on May 7th, these attacks by India in response to the terrorist attack in the Kashmir were aimed at what they called terrorist targets. India claims they hit 9 terrorist targets. Pakistan claims they hit 5 targets and that they weren't all terrorist targets. Many of them were civilian targets. Whatever. Anyway, there was a big, big attack. One of the interesting things about this is that Pakistan claims to have shot down 5 Indian fighter bombers. The French-made Rafale fighter bombers, and then a MiG-29 and an Su-30, which are Russian-made. Anyway, they claim to have shot down 5. India has not said they've shot down anything. They said they're going to talk about losses that they took at some point in the future after this thing's over. Maybe with the ceasefire announcement, they will get to that point where they'll talk about the losses that they took. I was doing some counting of what was being reported out, trying to figure it out. At least 2 actually appeared to have been shot down. And there are persistent reports that evening or that night, there was a dogfight that took place well over an hour, maybe longer, that involved 125 aircraft total from both sides, or total with both sides involved. That would be the largest air-to-air combat situation we've seen since World War II. Whatever was happening in the skies is truly stunning. And with that, you saw the introduction into combat operations of the Chinese J-10C fighter or fighter bomber some of the latest Chinese aviation technology. China's been doing this massive ramp up of its military, especially its air force. And so this was its debut on the world combat stage to see this. And along with that was a thing called the PL-15. It's got about a 40-mile range on it, air-to-air missile. And we're going to find out more, but it looks like the J-10Cs and these PL-15 missiles played a big role in downing Indian aircraft. And so everybody, to include the United States, all of our allies, are very much focused on what exactly happened that evening, doing the forensics to figure out what took place in the sky, because this is something, well, frankly, we haven't seen much. As I mentioned, it was the largest air-to-air combat we've seen since World War II. But you look at a lot of these wars that we've had, we haven't seen a lot of air-to-air combat, a lot of dogfighting. It just doesn't happen. If you look on the War on Terror, there was no dogfighting, all right? Basically, the U.S. came in, and we had air superiority, then air supremacy, and we maintained that. You know, in Afghanistan and Iraq, there was certainly no Taliban air force that we had to worry about. There was nothing from the Iraqis we really had to worry about in terms of in the air, so to speak. And so we just hadn't run into that. And we, you know, with the exception of air defense missiles, we haven't seen anything over the Houthi areas of Yemen. And if you look across the board, big air-to-air combat stuff is just not something that we've seen a lot of in recent decades. It's, you know, basically, you know, a lot of the F-18 guys, a lot of the folks that fly these things, you know, when they talk about success and they look at their careers, they prosecute a lot of ground targets, but there's not a lot of fire aces because there was nothing to, you got to get five air kills, if you will, for an ace. Well, there was no way to get five air kills because in these fights, you never saw five aircraft out there total that you could shoot down. So this is a big deal. This is a big deal. All right. Now this, the back and forth, there was the line of control, which is, I'm not going to call it a border because it's a disputed area, but the line of control between the Pakistani-controlled Kashmir, Jammu areas, and the Indian Jammu areas saw a lot of back and forth with artillery, presumably mortars, rockets, whatever was going back and forth there, along with shooting across the border. Eventually, this got to where they were targeting longer range with at least drones, if not missiles, but drones definitely, military facilities. And that's where everybody got involved. And it was interesting. The White House, President Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance initially said, this is not our war. These guys have been fighting forever and ever. We're not going to get involved. I think someone kind of sat down and explained to him, this is what could happen. These are the implications of what could take place if this thing escalates. And at that point, it was very clear the White House realized, oh, yeah, this is not our war, but this is not a war that we can allow to escalate because it could literally destroy not just South Asia, but it could destroy the global economy. It could cause mass famine throughout the world, and I'll get more into that in a second. So on the morning of Saturday, May 10th, the world was greeted with an announcement by President Trump that the U.S. had negotiated a ceasefire. It wasn't clear initially if that really was the case because both sides appeared to be kind of firing stuff. And I'm going to put this into the fog of war, if you will. Much of this may have been attributed to either miscommunication or communication lag, or the fact that they had already launched drone missions or something that they couldn't pull back. And so for a few hours there was still bombs raining down. And the question was, are they really in a ceasefire? It wasn't quite clear what was going on. But by Sunday, May 11th, things really started to settle down and it looked like a ceasefire was kind of holding. Now, the great fear is nuclear weapons. Each side has, I think India has 180 plus nuclear weapons. Pakistan has 170 plus nuclear warheads. About 40 kiloton range on average, some less, maybe some a little bit more, but that was about an average, 40 kilotons. And with that 350 total weapons, you can imagine the implications on this could be enormous. 350 40 kiloton nuclear weapons going off in the subcontinent would be huge. By the way, just for reference, the Fat Boy nuclear bomb that hit that the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima that caused, you know, the worst nuclear devastation that we've seen anywhere. That was, depends on which account, 12 to 18, but I've heard most seem to settle on is about 13 kilotons. So when you talk about 40 kilotons, you're talking about a nuclear warhead three times more powerful than the thing that destroyed Hiroshima in 1945, just to give you an idea. Not the most powerful nuclear weapon in the world. You know, you're talking 40, you know, we're talking, we have 300 kiloton. There's been megaton weapons that have been dropped, in fact, are tested. That's one of the reasons why that the U.S. signed a nuclear test ban treaty with the Soviet Union back in the 1960s, because just those above ground tests were kicking up so much radiation into the stratosphere that was impacting the global food chain, impacting things like showing up in milk that was going to kids and babies. And they said, okay, this has got to stop. We were contaminating the world, and there were some pretty dire predictions on what would happen if we didn't stop these tests. You can imagine what 350 kilotons would do in terms of radiation. It would basically cover the globe in massive increased radiation. That's not necessarily an immediate killer, but it is a killer. It is something that will show up over time with cancer and other things that will cause serious effects, but also it'll kick up so much soot, so much smoke into the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere area, that you're looking at the potential of what we call a nuclear winter, where it's blocking so much sunlight that the Earth's temperature drops several degrees. And that's enough that you're going to have crop failures that will result in famines. And, you know, initially, an exchange like this, we would say probably when you look at the populations of each country, you're probably talking hundreds or hundreds of millions that will be killed in fairly short order, not necessarily killed immediately with the blast and the heat, the incineration, everything takes place with the nuclear explosion itself. But certainly in very short order, you'll see hundreds of millions of killed. But over time, potentially you could see billions of killed. And that billions would extend across the Eurasian landmass and depending on air flows, extend much further, because what happens in South Asia doesn't stay in South Asia when it comes to upper atmosphere issues. So you get the idea. This is why the U.S. had to get involved, and we just ducked what I would call a global catastrophe. So anyway, by the way, my personal background on this, I was the director of intelligence of a U.S.-led multinational task force that was stationed in the area that included our air responsibility, included Pakistan, and there were heightened tensions at the time. And so long story short, I got very much involved with looking at the potential of what if. And so this is something that I've spent a lot of time working on and have a little bit more knowledge than average, than certainly more knowledge than your average intelligence officer, but more average knowledge than most about that. All right, let's talk about the nuclear talks. Steve Witkoff, President Trump's envoy to so many different things, to include the Iran talks. They had multiple talks, and one of the problems that came out of the talks initially, and the White House and Witkoff himself took a lot of criticism, was they came out and they said, oh, we've got, it looks like we got the seeds of an agreement, and we're going to allow the Iranians to enrich uranium up to 3.67%. All right, and both sides of the aisle came back and said, that's exactly what President Trump said in his first term as one of the reasons why the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the multinational agreement to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons, that was one of the faults with that that was cited, was it allows Iran to enrich uranium. And Iran, and at the time I said Iran should have no ability to enrich uranium. By the way, another criticism was that it didn't curtail Iran supporting terrorism and paramilitary military actions by its proxies throughout the region. And we've certainly seen that demonstrated heavily over the last 19, 18 months, whatever. And so that was another criticism, and ballistic missiles. Again, I would point back to the fact that we've seen two launches, massive launches of ballistic missiles from Iran going over to Israel. Thank God none of them had a nuclear warhead involved, but we get a sense of just how big this was. Well, he came back, and the criticism was that what he was describing was called, it was an Obama, the JCPOA was under Obama, so it was being called Obama 2. And obviously the White House did not like those headlines, where what they were proposing was the Obama 2, which was going back to basically the same treaty that they had pulled out of in his first term of office. So anyway, after some back and forth where it wasn't quite clear where the U.S. position was, it seemed to be resting on, you know, first, we're not going to let Iran get nuclear weapons. And then it seemed to settle that we are not going to allow Iran to have the ability to enrich uranium. That is a key point the Israelis have been saying all along, which is that Iran should not have any ability to enrich uranium. And there was discussion of providing enriched uranium for Iranian nuclear, civilian nuclear facilities, but it would be provided. It would not be stuff that they would be able to do. And then there was some confusion where they said, well, we're not going to allow them to enrich uranium, but we will allow them to keep the centrifuges that they need to enrich uranium. And with Iran's track record of hiding all of its activities or hiding its activities dealing with enrichment of uranium and developing nuclear weapons, everyone says you can't allow that to happen, because if they have the centrifuges, there is no way to know. There's no way that we can actually verify that they're enriching or not enriching, and to what degree. So anyway, long story short, The U.S. pulled that back. They said, look, we're not going to allow them to have an enrichment capability. Now, Iran has come back and said, that is a red line for us. If we can't produce uranium, that is an absolute. We must have that ability to produce our own uranium for our own civilian nuclear power capability. So anyway, they met in Oman this weekend. They talked, and both sides described the talks as disappointing, that nothing had really come from them. And with all that, I should mention in the background, the U.S. has had already, several weeks back, deployed B-2 stealth bombers to Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. More recently, in the last week, satellite imagery showed that there were at least two or more B-52 Stratofortresses, older aircraft, but they have the ability to launch a variety of ordnance at a distance. They can carry a lot of cruise missiles. I think at one time I saw they could carry 30 or 40 cruise missiles that they could use for a variety of purposes. Anyway, long story short, those are huge missile platforms. The B-2s can also drop something called the Massive Ordnance Penetrator Bomb, or MOP, MOP. This is a 30,000-pound bomb that when it hits, it can, with a delayed fuse, it goes deep into the ground, explodes, and causes catastrophic shock waves that destroy underground bunkers and facilities. All right, it's unparalleled in terms of what it can do. And frankly, there aren't many things that can drop that. The B-2 being something that actually can fly in using stealth technology and get into a position where it can drop this massive bomb that can destroy those underground facilities, such as what Iran does or has to build nuclear weapons, some of its drones, whatever, missiles, etc. These vast underground facilities that Iran has that they do this stuff with, the B-2 can do that. The other thing, too, is it's not flying from the United States. That's been B-2 strikes historically, not that there's been a lot of them. They fly all the way from, I believe, Ohio to wherever they got to go, anywhere in the world. It's been, it was reported some years back we had B-2s that were stationed in Guam, but that's not really, neither are really great for the Middle East for those two. A lot of aerial refueling going back and forth, really long legs, which makes it's like you can use it, but you don't get a lot of sorties. You get one sortie, they come back, and with all the maintenance required with the B-2 bomber, you may not see another sortie for quite some time. With Diego Garcia, that's in the Indian Ocean. That's within relatively easy striking distance. I know there might be a refueling mission, aerial refueling en route and coming back. I'm not quite sure, but I don't even think they have to do that. There might be a refueling coming back, but anyway, they could go in there and do a lot of sorties. Potentially you could see B-2 bomber sorties going literally every night, hitting these things and essentially reducing these facilities one by one, destroying their infrastructure in that regard. So that's a pretty big deal. All right. What does this mean? Well, what it means is Israel, last time it struck, did a major job on destroying the Iranian air defenses. If this was to happen, it would probably be a joint Israeli-U.S. thing. The U.S. would support them, but our support would probably include using our bomber capability after Israel had pretty much destroyed the air defense capability of the Iranians, and with that, air defense missiles, air defense radars, everything goes with that, but had achieved complete air supremacy over Iran, then the U.S. might come in and start reducing these big bunker installations. All right. Now, I want to talk a little bit about what just happened in Kyiv. It's interesting to see what happened in Kyiv, because what's going on is, it's really, to me, it's a big shift. There was a big meeting going on in Norway with the Northern Joint Task Force. It's the area that they're going to work with, that northern flank, defending NATO's northern flank. Anyway, the nations met there. However, the heads of state of Britain, France, Germany, and Poland all went to Kyiv. The only one way to get to Kyiv is by train. So they all did this secret movement where they got to Poland and got in a train. I don't know if they were all in the same train. Got to remember, this is a combat, it's a war zone. All right. So there is a certain inherent danger of these various leaders being in one train, even multiple trains. Anyway, they all went to Kyiv. They met with Ukrainian President Zelensky. They had this big meeting. It was a big virtual thing where they had a lot of people coming in. Out of this, they said, look, if Putin doesn't agree to a 30-day unconditional ceasefire to start Monday, May 12th, then we're going to impose these massive sanctions. And then they all got on the phone and called President Trump before 7 a.m. Washington, D.C. time, and just said, hey, are you with us? And he said, yes, I'm with you on this. And so they're major screws, if you will, on Putin. He's got till Monday, May 12th to do this. And the response from Russia so far has been these maximalist demands, you know, that basically is, yeah, we'll agree to a temporary ceasefire, which will allow us to eventually, you know, take over Ukraine, destroy the government, do all these things. You know, one of the things we require as a part of a ceasefire is a complete disarming of the Ukrainian military, President Zelensky removed from office, and everything. I suppose I could add, and by the way, we'd love to have the road paved with gold that goes to Kyiv to take over the entire country. That is not flying. And whereas there was a very uncomfortable period where the Trump administration was trying to somehow, I don't know if you want to say appease, whatever, trying to somehow soften the rhetoric to Putin, or at least to be less critical of Putin and Russia, in some cases saying things that sound exactly like what Russia was saying, that period appears to be coming to an end, at least I personally hope so. And the reality is that Putin, you know, has no interest in some long-term peace. And also the reality is, if you look at what Putin's done to his economy in this war, it has completely shifted over to a wartime economy. 40% of the gross domestic product is tied up with fighting the war. I don't know if Putin is even in a place where he can stop the war and survive politically without achieving essentially complete victory. The losses have been so substantial, close to a million, according to the Kyiv, according to the Ukrainian Ministry of the Armed Forces, Russia has lost close to a million men in this war. It's just phenomenal losses. So he has to have some big victory. And by the way, if the war suddenly ends, then he has to have all these soldiers come back and they're unemployed on the streets and they're frustrated and angry with what they saw in the war. And you have a bunch of unemployed defense workers that suddenly appear on the streets, you have a very volatile mixture where I think he'd be very concerned that that he could see a regime change situation happen in Moscow. So anyway, these European leaders took the lead. Used to be that the U.S. under President Biden was taking the lead and kind of pulling the European leaders with us. And now it seems to be going the other way. And now it's completely going the other way. European leaders have stepped up, as they were asked to do, to take the lead. They are now leaning forward. They are pledging lots of support, not the least of which is a brokered deal with 16 nations led by the Czech Republic, where 800,000 large caliber artillery rounds are going to Ukraine to boost their war effort. Just, you know, put that into the math of the daily use of artillery and stuff. What you see is an ability of Ukraine to sustain significant volumes of artillery fire on its front lines for an extended period of time. In other words, with that type of artillery, depending on how fast it gets there, Russia's not going to see any major advancements on the battlefield anytime this year. That's it. The Ukrainians will be able to hold. In fact, in some places, they may be able to hold back. The other thing, too, it's this whole thing with the European support is they're keeping Ukraine in the fight. The U.S., the money that the U.S. and the aid the U.S. has been sending over for military, that's kind of winding down. It's almost gone. Fortunately, the intelligence sharing is still happening, but after that was temporarily paused as well. But the bottom line is that this keeps Ukraine in the fight. In some places, they're pushing back on stuff. Now, the status of the U.S. trying to cut some deal with the Russians directly and then force the Ukrainians to accept whatever it is, that seems to be sort of going by the wayside. I think everyone's realized that Putin was in, and Trump actually, President Trump actually said this, was he said, I think it was said he was tapping me along, which means basically that Putin was playing him. he was playing for time. He was playing Trump. And I think Trump realized he was being not only being played, but that everybody was perceiving he was being played. And I think that shifted the political calculus of the White House on where they needed to stand. So Putin sees, as I mentioned, any negotiations a prelude to surrender. But I think this is a strategic inflection point. I think the Europeans are, and by the way, the Europeans have every reason to do this, because if the Europeans cannot stop the Russians in Ukraine, it threatens all these other areas, particularly the Baltic states are threatened. Poland feels threatened. The Suwalki Gap, that where, you know, basically Kaliningrad, which is Russian, is cut off physically, territorially, if you will, from the rest of Russia. It's a little area that sits in the Baltic, just south of Lithuania. That gap, that would close that gap, if you will, that area, that's a threat, and that threat runs right through Polish territory and Lithuanian territory as well. Anyway, that Russia might try to close that militarily, and that would put Russia at war with you know, NATO. And so the most cost-effective thing to do is to keep Ukraine in the fight and hopefully push back Putin's forces more than they have been pushed back, and maybe trigger something in Moscow that might result in a more amenable regime over Russia. I know it sounds rather aspirational, but I think that's part of the thinking, is whatever you do, just don't let Russia win. The other thing, too, is the ground is changing. As you saw, the Russians pushed the Ukrainians largely out of Kursk, which is a Russian oblast or Russian province that Ukraine had made huge gains in. The Ukrainians may not be completely out of Kursk, unlike what the Russians are saying, but they have been pushed dramatically back with what they're saying. And with that, one of the big innovations on the battlefield is fiber optic drones or UAVs. These are the first-person view drones. These are these battlefield drones. They have fiber optic cables as opposed to radio, which means they can't be jammed with electronic warfare means. And they go out there and they hit. Now, the Ukrainians actually had the chance to implement this first. They did not. The Russians did. The Russians tend not to be great innovators on the battlefield, but they did. They had great success. The Ukrainians have been catching up really fast, so now they've got a bunch of these drones. The other thing, though, the Ukrainians do have an advantage on is unmanned ground vehicles that they've been using for a variety of things. Mine clearing, going in there, blowing up enemy positions, all sorts of stuff. Again, you don't have to put troops at risk because you have an unmanned thing doing this. And frankly, I think if you see a big change on the battlefield, if you see them clear a minefield and obstacles and make a big breakthrough attack, I think that will be led by a combination of fiber optic drones and these unmanned ground vehicles clearing the way before they put troops forward. So I think this could be a big deal, and I'd be truly remiss if I didn't mention that recently an unmanned surface vessel, a sea drone, if you will, or maritime drone, fired an anti-aircraft missile that brought down an advanced Russian fighter or fighter bomber, and that was over the Black Sea. That is a big change. That's a big change because one of the big things that Russia does to counter these USVs is they use aircraft. Now, all of a sudden, all the aircraft are aware. And by the way, they took down a very advanced fighter bomber. What they've been mostly using is helicopters. And all of a sudden, these helicopter pilots are aware that they are in harm's way when they go to try and stop one of these things, that they could become the target, collateral damage, if you will, as part of that USV's larger mission. So anyway, long story short, this whole drone revolution has really taken hold in a way that could change this war even faster. So there's a lot going on in the world. Thanks for listening to Strat, and please visit stratpodcast.com. You can also see my various news segments on YouTube on the Hal Kipfer TV channel, or go to www.gripsa, that's the .com. That's the website for Global Risk Intelligence and Planning, and you can see more of this stuff. So thank you for staying tuned. Thank you for taking some time to listen to the Strat Podcast or watch the Strat Podcast, and see you next week.